The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you very much. You may be seated. And good morning to everyone. We will begin with introductions from the court. I am Mike Habakin, the Chief Justice, and now by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves. But before we get to that, I should note that Justices Funk and Frydenberg are recused from this matter, so Judge Strong and Judge Smith, both district court judges, they don't know this, but they are going to introduce themselves in just a minute also. Judge Strong will introduce herself first, and then Judge Smith. But back to introductions by service as to service on the court.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller-Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Jonathan Papik. Good morning.
Susan Strong, District Court of Lancaster County. Good morning.
Michael Smith, District Court of Cass-Sarpy Counties. Good morning.
Thank you, all of the members of the court this morning. Counsel, Mr. Schneider, are you here this morning?
Yes, Your Honor.
You are indeed. And Mr. Phelps, you're here also?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Schneider, you may then approach and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justices, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time.
I should say this is Murphy versus State of Nebraska.
That's correct, Your Honor, it is. May it please the court, my name is James Schneider. I'm counsel for the appellants in this case, who are the plaintiffs below. As this court may know from reviewing the briefing, this case presents a pretty difficult subject matter and a complex fact pattern. In 1994, my clients, Joshua Murphy, Abigail Saylor, and Sydney Murphy, were placed into the care and custody of the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services following a car crash that disabled their mother to the point where she could not care for them, and a finding that their father was unfit to care for them as well. In 1995 and in 1996, my clients were placed by DHHS into a foster home, the foster home of Carol and Miles Rook. At the time they were placed there, they were between the ages of 1 and 5 years old. Over the next 10 years or so, until 2004, my clients were subjected to extensive physical and sexual abuse at the hands of both Miles and Carol Rook. In 2004, when that was finally discovered, the state removed them from the Rook home, and a few months later placed them in 2005 into the home of Donald Murphy, their biological father. Shortly thereafter, less than a year thereafter, my clients were removed from the home of Donald Murphy when it was discovered that Donald Murphy was also sexually abusing all three children. My clients brought a claim for negligence against the state of Nebraska and the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services under the State Tort Claims Act. The District Court of Richardson County held a trial on that last summer in June of 2021. And after a few months' deliberation, the District Court ruled against my clients, finding that the state acted with reasonable care commensurate with the circumstances. Now, we take issue with the District Court's order on three broad grounds, as discussed in our brief, and I'm actually going to go out of order from our brief because I think the second one is the most important one. The court relied on things that were not in evidence before it when it reached its conclusion. And specifically, the most egregious example of this is the court's reliance on an administrative rule, 390 Nebraska Administrative Code, Chapter 11, Section 002.01E. The problem with the court's reliance upon that particular rule is that it's nowhere in the record before you.
Can a court not take judicial notice of an administrative regulation of the state of Nebraska?
Judge, I think it can. The problem is that this court in its prior orders has been very specific about how a court can do that. And it's been very specific that when taking judicial notice, particularly of an administrative rule, it can be very difficult to prove the language of the rule, the existence of the rule, the application of the rule.
And haven't there been legislative changes to the statutes regarding taking judicial notice of rules and regulations after many of the cases upon which you rely?
Judge, there may have been, but I think the problem here that, and I'm referencing specifically, you're holding an In Re Estate of Radford in 2017, where what the court said is that when a trial court fails to take actual judicial notice, fails to show the language of the rule, fails to tell the parties that it's taking notice of the judicial, of the administrative rule, it deprives this court of any kind of meaningful judicial review. And I think that's one of the problems here.
Are you arguing that the rule has changed over the period of time?
Are you talking about the administrative rule?
The administrative rule.
That's one of the problems here, Judge. I don't know. I've never seen the text of the rule. And in fact, the month before, the state told the district court, and the only time it's mentioned in the trial is on the state's motion for directed verdict in oral argument. At that time, the rule had been repealed for a month. It was repealed the month before the state told the court to rely upon it. But your question goes to the larger point, I think, and this is the difficulty when a court fails to mark and acknowledge and say, I'm taking judicial notice of this, is that the parties have no idea. And it's demonstrated by the fact that the district court cites to the base rule, but in the state's brief, they cite to the 1998 revision of the rule. Respectfully, just, I don't have the rule before the change. I don't have the 1998 revision. I don't have the text of the language of the rule after. That's the problem here.
Aren't all of those publicly available through the Secretary of State?
Well, that's one of the problems. When we got the trial court's order, I went and I tried to pull the rule. And if you go to the website, we included a link to the website in our brief. You can't get to it. Right? It says it's been repealed. It's no longer on the website for the Secretary of State.
I think that perhaps answers part of my question.
Right.
But don't you think the Secretary of State maintains copies of superseded rules?
It may very well. And I think that's one of the issues that I have with the district court's order. The state was at trial. If it wanted to rely upon that rule or rely upon revisions or certain languages, then it could have pulled that rule from the Secretary of State and offered a certified copy. Right, that could have gone into the record. And that's one of the arguments the state also makes, is that you can take judicial notice of that rule, the district court could, because it was signed and delivered to the governor. There's no evidence of that in the record, but if there was a certified copy, there very well might be.
Why should administrative rules be treated any differently than statutes? I mean, we don't require a court to mark statutes. It's the law.
Right.
Well, and aren't administrative rules that are properly adopted and promulgated also have the effect of statutory law?
Well, I take two issues with that. One would go back to the court's statements before that administrative rules can be difficult to prove the existence. And that's true in this case, right? Where the facts of this case are 20 to 30 years old, and there's some evidence now with the state's brief that there was a change to the rule. Without evidence, without foundational testimony that that rule was in place in 1997 or 96 or 95, that makes it very difficult for any party to anticipate what that rule is and how it might work. The second point I would make is that statutes, to my knowledge, change when the legislature changes the law. Administrative codes can change based on how the governor, and there's a whole different process for doing that, that some of that is shielded from public view, some of it's not shielded from public view. So that would be more of a policy argument as to why, but that would be why I would argue they're different, because administrative rules are simply much more malleable than statutes are. And so that's one of our main problems, I think, is that the court referenced facts that were not in evidence, both through that administrative rule and through some other issues in our brief. And shortly, I'd also like to address the district court's granting of the directed verdict motion. My clients also brought claims relating to their placement in 2005 into the biological home of Donald Murphy, their biological father. One of the problems with this case, again, it's 20 to 30 years old, we have to rely on records a lot more than we could actual testimony. So if you look at the record, at the transcript, the first part of this case, the trial, was a mass offer of records. The plaintiffs offered a lot of records, the state did not object to any of them, and they were accepted into evidence. Then there were 2 or 3 days of testimony and a motion for directed verdict. The court then partially granted that directed verdict. And if you look at what the court discusses when it does so, it says, I didn't hear any testimony about Donald Murphy. The only thing I really heard is that he had been sober for 3 years. And so it partially grants the directed verdict and dismisses the portion of plaintiff's claims related to placement with Donald Murphy. The issue I take with that is that if you look at what was actually in the record before the court, there was a significant amount of evidence that Mr. Murphy was not somebody who you should place children with, including multiple, I think, 4 DUI convictions, the fact that he was committed to a mental hospital after attempting suicide, multiple domestic assault convictions, including some against children. All of that was evidence before the district court when it made its ruling on directed verdict. I think a reasonable mind might think somebody with domestic assault convictions would not be a reasonable place to place children. That was before them. And as you know, if there's any evidence in the record supporting the non-moving party on a directed verdict, that motion should not be granted. And if you look at the state's brief, what they largely say is that, well, the court, you know, correctly found that a reasonable person, wouldn't think it was a big deal to place with Don Murphy, and that's just absurd on its face to me. I think if the court wanted to reach this conclusion after weighing evidence, it could do so. Shouldn't have done so on directed verdict.
One of the grounds for the DHHS's motion for directed verdict included the exemption under the State Tort Claims Act for claims arising from assault.
Yeah.
And the DHHS relied on this court's decision in Mosier.
Sure.
The court overruled that aspect of the motion for directed verdict.
It did.
Can we ignore that ruling on appeal? It's not been the subject of a cross appeal.
Right.
But it is jurisdictional, is it not?
It is jurisdictional. And
what is your position on that while you're here in front of us?
Of course. Well, and as you know, this was not something that was briefed. So I'd have two things I'd start there. One, not something that was briefed, and the state says in its brief that you do have jurisdiction. So that's there. And if this
can the state's waiver in an appeal like this create jurisdiction if it didn't otherwise exist?
No.
Okay.
But the point I was making is if you're thinking about dismissing this case on jurisdictional grounds, I beg you, please give us time to brief it. Give us some supplemental briefing to come back and argue jurisdiction before you. My position is that no, it's not, and my time's out, but I'll reference a case really quick. Cope v. York County, 198, Nebraska 67. If you go look at that case from 1977, the court there found that these kinds of claims do not arise out of assault and battery. If you compare that with Mosier's language, which talks about a return to the actual prior case law before a Doe case in 2007, 1977 is before 2007. And so I would submit that these kinds of claims do not fall under the Mosier exception, and I have many arguments on that I'd brief.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schneider. Mr. Feltz. Good morning to you, and
good morning, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Christopher Feltz with the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the State of Nebraska and the Department of Health and Human Services. Everyone familiar with the facts of this case agree that what happened to the appellants as children is a tragedy. But the questions before the court today are ones of legal liability. And I would like to focus on the appellant's second assignment of error.
Before you do so, could you address subject matter jurisdiction and the exemption under the State Tort Claims Act for claims arising out of assault?
Yes, Your Honor. The question of Mosier's applicability came up at trial because Mosier was decided in between summary judgment and the time of the actual trial. And we did not raise the denial of sovereign immunity on appeal because there was a complex question of a timing element related to the issue of whether the state has sovereign immunity when that ruling comes out after the summary judgment was decided. And the trial court below focused on an analysis under Russell v. Cherry and Kearns v. Grammer to say that because of the timing element that it would not, that Mosier would not apply.
And so the trial court offered two rationales for
yes,
not
Your
applying
Honor.
The exemption for claims arising out of assault. One was that Mosier should not be applied retroactively because it was unexpected. I believe the trial court's term was unexpected.
Yes, Your Honor.
The other rationale was distinguishing Mosier from prior cases. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the state's position on both of those? rationales.
Yeah, our position would be that because of that timing element, the trial court's ruling about whether it should apply retroactively because it unexpectedly changed the law, that we declined to take a position on that issue in the appeal in this case.
Well, I'm asking now what your position is.
Yes, Your Honor. We would submit that under this specific case, under these facts, that Mosier shouldn't have been retroactively applied. It was a unique situation where it was the day of the trial that was brought to the court's attention and everybody was already prepared to address the issue. As far as the second part about subject matter jurisdiction, we do believe the court can address that if the court arrives at the conclusion that there is no subject matter jurisdiction on that part of the appeal because Mosier does apply.
On behalf of DHHS, do you believe that this court's decision in the 1977 case of Kep can be reconciled with our reasoning in Mosier?
Your Honor, I believe the court so far hasn't addressed that specific issue, and if you look at the facts and the situation in Mosier, I do believe that our trial counsel was correct to raise the issue and say that Mosier should apply in the facts of this particular case. But I'd like to address the second assignment of error about the finding of no breach because the analysis there is very complex. They're alleging clear error with the trial court's finding that DHHS did not breach its duty. But then in its argument, it points to individual findings of fact that it says were clearly erroneous. And in order to actually reach the ultimate finding of fact, the appellants have to show not only that the trial court clearly erred in one of those individual findings of fact, but that those errors combine to make the ultimate finding of no breach clearly erroneous as well. So in essence, the appellants have a burden on that second assignment of error to show clear error twice. And this is an incredibly high bar because it occurs only where the court's findings are unsupported by the evidence. But the trial court painstakingly set out in approximately a dozen pages all of its findings of fact, and then tied those findings of fact to its individual findings and conclusions, excuse me, that breach did not occur. And it's worth keeping in mind that in this case, on the summary judgment stage, the trial court actually found that there was two different levels of duty concerning the question of breach, because there was a duty under the CUP, the York County case, while the children were in the care and custody of DHHS, and that's a standard of reasonable care commensurate with the circumstances. And then once the guardianship was ordered, so for the majority of the time that they were in the Rooks' home, DHHS had the same duty that it owes to all Nebraska families under 43706.
Is there any evidence in our record that the county court judge, who was sitting as a juvenile court judge in this case, was ever apprised of any of the reports of abuse before that 2007 hearing when the guardianship was terminated?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. There was therapy notes and the regular intake reports that DHHS made that were submitted as what is called a part of the case plan and court report.
And those would appear in the county court file?
Yes, Your Honor. Each child has an individual file, and their files are in the record. So I'm not aware of specific testimony about any of the reports, but the court did receive the sum total of all of the documents that the caseworker would prepare as a part of that case plan and court report.
Thank you.
As to some of the individual findings of fact, particularly the use of the administrative code, we would take the position that it was not error for the court to judicially notice a section of the admin code. It cited to what section it was using, and it quoted the exact language that it was using. And then it used that language to address one of the assignments of negligence in the complaint. But we'd also submit that even if it was error for the court to take judicial notice of that section of the admin code, that doesn't rise to give rise to the conclusion that the trial court's finding that no breach occurred is clearly erroneous. That was just one of many, many findings that the court made concerning DHHS's duty. And so it doesn't actually alter the outcome concerning the appellant's ultimate assignment of error. The appellants also take issue with a claim that the trial court said each allegation of abuse was investigated. And we clarified in our brief DHHS's investigation process, because the appellants essentially say that intake reports do not count as an investigation. And we would submit that that is the first step of DHHS's investigation process. And
at trial, DHHS called one witness, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did that witness testify as to anything about the procedure for the intakes or the investigation or any of that?
No, Your Honor.
So what evidence is in our record that educates us on what sort of investigation, if any, DHHS conducted in response to an intake report?
The policy for DHHS, the guidebook, I don't recall the exact exhibits, Your Honor, but the language of the guidebook itself, which was the regulations DHHS uses, is a part of the evidence. It was in the 200 or so exhibits that were offered at the beginning of trial. I apologize, I don't
So
have
was there
it.
Testimony that said there is a process, we followed it, or there is a process?
The guidebook has the process, and then the individual intake reports themselves filled out by the caseworkers are also in evidence. And at the end of each of those intake reports is a screening process. The last page that it undergoes is a question of should it go on for initial assessment or not. And the individual, if it doesn't go on for individual assessment, identifies those reasons and marks that in the report.
And then it's department's position that is an investigation?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the first step of its investigatory process, because it takes in information, it takes in all of the available information at the time, and then they make a determination whether that report is founded or unfounded and whether it should go on for a second part of the investigation.
So during trial,
in the initial assessment.
I'm sorry to interrupt, that was rude. During trial, the plaintiffs offered the testimony of Ms. Hollison, I believe is how you pronounce it, but I'm not entirely sure, a former DHHS supervisor.
Yes, Your Honor.
I didn't see any reference to that witness's testimony in the judge's order. Did I overlook it?
No, Your Honor.
So the judge didn't, in all those pages of factual findings that you've discussed, there wasn't any factual finding with respect to that testimony, correct?
That's correct.
And didn't that witness testify that DHHS knew or should have known about the abuse and should have removed the children?
I see I'm out of time. Can I finish your question?
You may.
Thank you. The testimony, as I recall, that individual testified to what kinds of things constitute red flags within their training, and that in hindsight, in reviewing the totality of the circumstances, she did identify that there were some red flags. I don't, at this point, recall that she specifically said that they should have been removed from the home.
If the record shows that testimony, what would your response be to the fact that it's not mentioned at all in the discussion of duty or breach of duty?
I would submit if the court finds that individual omission of a finding is enough to point the court to an issue of clear error, then the case should be remanded with instructions then to consider the issues of proximate cause and damages at that point, Your Honor.
Has there been any assignment of error in this appeal regarding the sufficiency of the findings of the trial court?
No, Your Honor. What the court, what the assignment of error takes is, again, an overarching position on the ultimate finding of no breach, and then to support it points to specific errors of finding. And so that's why there's a, I believe, a two-level analysis at play here, where you have to say something at the individual level of findings of fact was clearly erroneous, and that that then gave rise to a finding that the ultimate finding of breach was also clearly erroneous, which means that whatever error occurred would have to weigh against all of the other findings that the court did explicitly make in order to conclude no breach had occurred.
So in assessing a directed verdict at the appellate level, what is the question? What is the standard of review? Is it whether or not the trial judge's findings at that point are fully supported by the record, or is it no reasonable jury could have found for the plaintiffs? Game over? What do we do?
Yes, Your Honor. I direct the court to a recent decision, State v. Williams, that talks about the standard for a directed verdict and how a motion to dismiss in a non-jury trial is equivalent to that. And the directed verdict is only proper where reasonable minds cannot differ and draw one conclusion from the evidence so that it should be decided as a matter of law. So it's our position that the court was right to take a look at the entire record and then ask themselves, could a reasonable person find that the appellants had made the case that it was reasonably foreseeable for DHHS in 2004 to see that Mr. Murphy was going to sexually abuse his children? And the court concluded that that evidence was not there, and so they granted the directed verdict.
So with the chief's indulgence, I'd like to ask another question.
He certainly may.
All right. Your opponent makes an argument about the trial court taking judicial notice, and I understood from his argument he was talking about notice taken in the court's decision rather than taken at trial. Assuming that that's the case, was there any attempt to use a motion for new trial, a motion to alter or amend the judgment, or any other similar procedural technique to raise that matter in front of the trial court?
No, there was not, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So for the reasons discussed here today and set forth in our brief, we'd ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. Counsel, that concludes oral arguments in Murphy versus State of Nebraska. So, counsel, you are excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Wheelbarger versus Detroit Diesel. Judges.